This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
As we face down a climate shift to a new hot state, some scientists suggest Earth's systems are not that sensitive. Maybe we won't get to 3 degrees C warming by the year 2100. Others wonder if the huge economic impact from climate-driven disasters could derail our suicidal urge to burn all the fossil fuels we can find. Or maybe there's just a better way out than that. Those are the kind of questions Patrick Brown takes on in some of the most prestigious scientific journals. Dr. Patrick T. Brown is assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology and Climate Science at San Jose State University in California. He studied under the well-known Carnegie scientist Ken Caldera and still often publishes papers with him. Brown runs the Weather, Climate, and Human Systems Lab at San Jose U. From California, Patrick Brown, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, the questions you wrestle with are big picture for sure. Let's see what we can cover. I just talked with the French senior scientist Olivier Boucher, and his team finds the worst-case scenario could be 7 degrees C mean temperature increase over pre-industrial by the year 2100. I doubt that will happen. He doubts that will happen. But do you think we could survive 7 degrees C of warming in the unlikely event that it does?
I mean, 7 degrees C of warming over, you're talking about 80 years, is just a shock on the climate system that is, you know, really unprecedented. And it's very difficult to speculate what exactly would happen, you know, how society would shift and react to such a change. But it can't be good. I mean, given that the change between the last ice age and pre-industrial was about 4 or 5 degrees Celsius over thousands, you know, tens of thousands of years, if you're talking about like doubling that in a world with 10 billion people, and you're talking about over 100 years, you can just infer that that's going to be extremely difficult. But physical scientists like me speculating on exactly how society would adjust to that is exactly that. It's speculation. And so I don't want to say, you know, what exactly that would mean in terms of society itself.
In 2018, a team led by Peter M. Cox at the University of Exeter in the UK published a study saying climate sensitivity could be much lower. I think they said we probably would not get past 3 degrees C of heating. Could you explain their argument for us and then the reply you and Ken Caldera published in the journal Nature?
Sure. So we had a paper preceding theirs by just about a month, and then their paper came out, and then we had a comment on their paper, and they had a response to our paper. And these are all in using the same rough methodology, which is this emergent constraints methodology, it's called. And basically what that is we're using climate models to project temperature out into the future, and we don't know which ones are right. And so they give us this big spread of temperature projections out into the future. And so what the emergent constraint paradigm does is it says, okay, let's look at the models that are doing the best in terms of how they compare to recent observations, and then kind of weigh the projections in the future such that the best performing models get, you know, the most votes kind of in terms of what our expectation is for future warming. And so in our study, we used a number of variables having to do with the Earth's energy budget to constrain future warming. And we found that the most likely warming in the future was on the upper end of the range. And then Peter Cox and his team used basically the same type of methodology, but used a different observed variable and found that warming would be probably slightly lower than what the central estimate is. And they claimed that the upper end of the range was vastly reduced, so much less likely for very large values of warming. And so we were, you know, very curious about this result since it contradicted our own, and since it was using a similar methodology, we were kind of, you know, just set up to investigate it. And so we did a number of sensitivity tests on their results and found them basically not to be robust to different sensitivity tests. So I don't know, it's a little bit technical to get into for a program like this, but there's just a number of claims about how they're removing forcing from the historical record, that if you do it a more conventional way, then you essentially get a different result. And also one of their claims was that they had radically reduced the uncertainty in future warming. And that was really resting on the fact that they're starting with a number of climate models that already have a very reduced uncertainty compared to what we actually think the true uncertainty is. So if we think the true uncertainty is about 4.5 degrees Celsius warming for a doubling of CO2 to 1.5 degrees Celsius warming for a doubling of CO2, and that comes from a number of sources, but then you take a number of climate models that have a much smaller uncertainty and you do an analysis on them, that's going to naturally produce a smaller uncertainty in the future, and that doesn't really tell you anything. All that tells you is that the climate models themselves aren't representing the true range of uncertainty. It doesn't tell you that you've actually reduced the uncertainty through your analysis. And so that was one of the points that we were making in our comment. And so I think that overall the field is still debating this, and that you can use some observational parameters and get slightly above the model consensus and use different observational parameters and get below the model consensus. But this climate sensitivity uncertainty has been stubbornly persistent, that it's stayed there for a long time. And I don't think that it's going to be radically reduced anytime soon, honestly. I think we are basically going to have to move forward while not knowing exactly how much warming we're going to have in the future.
I agree. It's a scary thought, but I think that's what is really happening. Now, another problem is that big economic and climate reports just take our present human civilization and model it out into the future, and they don't seem to consider a big societal change or an economic crash or having to abandon parts of major cities like New York or Venice or Shanghai because of storm surges and rising seas. So a paper led by Don Woodward at the University of California calculated that damages from extreme climate change, in my opinion, could save humans from the worst levels of heating, or at least, she said, counterbalance warming from things like permafrost thaw and albedo changes. Patrick, could you take some time to explain what's going on with the Woodward-led argument?
Yes, as we continue to warm into the future, so we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and luckily for us, about 50% of the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean and the terrestrial biosphere. So the plants take up carbon and the ocean takes up carbon. And so that reduces the amount in the atmosphere. And so we, as far as warming is concerned, we only care about the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's good that the ocean and terrestrial biosphere are taking up carbon. It's not good for ocean acidification, I'll say that, but that's a separate issue. But as it gets warmer and warmer, we expect these carbon sinks, these fluxes out of the atmosphere from the terrestrial biosphere and from the ocean, to be less good at taking carbon out of the atmosphere. And so that's considered a positive carbon cycle feedback, that the more carbon we put into the atmosphere, the warmer it gets, and the less able the ocean and terrestrial biosphere are to pull carbon out of the atmosphere. And so that means that as you get warmer, you essentially get more and more warmer. And what this argument in the Woodward paper is showing is that we've also calculated that as it gets warmer, there will be damages to the economy. And since CO2 is essentially released when we produce energy to make goods and services, if there's damages to the economy, then we'll essentially release less CO2. And it's kind of this interesting calculation that they show. They're comparing the carbon cycle feedback from the terrestrial biosphere and from the ocean to this feedback on economic activity, and showing that, okay, as we get warmer and we start damaging our own economic activity, that will reduce CO2 emissions. Then you can think of the positive feedbacks from the terrestrial biosphere and ocean as increasing CO2 emissions to some degree. And those two things basically cancel out in their central calculation. So it's kind of this interesting result that's just saying that if neither one of these feedbacks was active, then we would have just as much warming in the future as if both of them were active.
And how do you feel about that argument?
Well, I don't think that it's very likely that society would just accept these large economic damages over the 21st century. So to mitigate climate change, if you were to impose a carbon tax, for example, that also slows economic growth from all the modeling that we do. But that's way more efficient in terms of if you wanted to maximize economic growth. It's way more efficient to impose a carbon tax and to reduce emissions that way than it is to just emit as much CO2 as you want and then feel the damages from climate change, right? Like through decreased crop yields and labor productivity and having to build seawalls and all this money spent on adaptation, all that stuff. And so I would hope and I would think that once those signals are being sent that we're actually damaging our own economy, that, you know, the foresight that would come along with that to actually implement policies would be implemented. And so we would reduce CO2 emissions and, yes, sacrifice some economic growth, but much less economic sacrifice than you would get from just experiencing all of the negative impacts from climate change. And so I think that's more likely. I mean, I feel like we're kind of seeing the tide turning now. I mean, it's been slow for several decades, but there's been momentum building for several decades up to the, you know, Paris Agreement. And then it just seems like the momentum is building and building for more and more policies to be implemented. I mean, here in California, for example, you know, we have laws on the books to be at zero net emissions, at least in electricity, you know, under short periods of time. So that seems like the direction that we're going. And again, I think that's the type of feedback. If you want to put humans into the dynamic system that you're studying, I think that's the type of feedback that would be more likely to be active than the damage to the economy feedback.
Well, I want to return a little later to the possibility of an intelligent human response, and that is our greatest hope. But meantime, the Wall Street crowd, it seems to me, hangs on to the broken window theory that climate damage may stimulate the economy rather than hurt it because, well, we have all those new buildings to make and new cities to replace and infrastructure to replace, and that means more jobs and business. What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me. If we get stronger and more powerful hurricanes from climate change and they start destroying our cities, that is not an economic benefit to say, oh, look, there's all these jobs now to rebuild our cities. Like if you have new jobs to create something that you already had, you're taking away that labor resource from some other production that it would have been doing and just using it to recreate what you already had. And so you're not creating any new goods and services. You're just taking resources away from something that would have been creating new goods and services and using it to create something that you already had. And so that doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, the same goes for some of the arguments of like green jobs, for example, that if you're increasing jobs for the same amount of, say, electricity produced, that is a cost on economic production. Now, I'm not saying that's not a cost that's worth it. It, I think, very well is a cost that's worth it. But that's why when we do these calculations of, you know, cost-benefit analysis of global warming policies, there is a cost there. It's not just always win, 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 win. I would very much agree that the broken windows fallacy is a fallacy and that creating quote-unquote jobs or things for people to do that is not new goods and services is not a economic benefit.
And trying to recover from climate change could also trigger another burst of carbon as we try to rebuild everything or change over to the new green economy. And so I just wonder, maybe we just have to do a lot less. And it brings me back to kind of Tim Garrett's argument from the University of Utah that the economy is really a heat engine. And the more you expand the economy, the more you expand the heat. And I think that's kind of what you've been saying all through this interview.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting. Like, it does seem like there's a big, you know, technological component. In terms of the energy intensity of the economy and the carbon intensity of the economy in the Western world, those have been decreasing, you know, not fast enough to meet various goals. But as we're getting richer, we are, in fact, becoming more efficient in a lot of things, right? So we're using less land per unit of calorie produced. Like, that's a good thing. We're using less materials in a lot of cases. And so there's definitely hope that these increases in efficiency can help us out. But yeah, there, you know, you can't grow indefinitely. that is something that if you have a closed system with limited resources, it's just the fact that you can't grow forever.
Well, and also, if we're more efficient per capita, but we increase our per capitas by another 2 or 3 billion people, it's still, the math doesn't work out in that sense.
Yeah, except for that, unlike the bacteria in a petri dish, humans, the better off we are, we seem to reproduce less, which is very interesting, right? That all the rich Western countries are at, you know, replacement level reproduction rates or less than that. And it's the poorest parts of the world where you have large fertility rates. And so that's, you know, an interesting thing to throw into the dynamics to see if raising per capita wealth would decrease fertility rates and decrease, you know, population growth. And so that's kind of another lever on the emissions reduction, you know, your toolkit there.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Patrick T. Brown from San Jose State University. We're discussing our future as the climate morphs due to greenhouse gas emissions. Patrick, let's work back to your 2017 paper, Change in the Magnitude and Mechanisms of Global Temperature Variability with Warming. In tune with the theme of your lab at San Jose, you raised the difficulty of trying to model a system that is in flux, and earlier science assessed the natural variability of the weather and then tried to model changes we would expect based on greenhouse gas emissions. But you ask, what if that natural variability also changes with the climate? Could you explain that problem and what you found?
Yeah, so, I mean, the vast majority of the variability that we experience is just internally generated from the Earth system, from the ocean atmosphere system. And so, you know, we know that, like, just from day-to-day experience, it could be very hot one week and then very cold the next week. And a lot of that has to do with just the Earth kind of moving warm and cold air masses around the surface. So when you experience it to be very cold in first, you know, a week, that means it's warm somewhere else because a cold air mass moved over you. And so then a warm air mass must have moved over them. And so this is the type of variability that we're studying. But we're studying how that variability changes when you change the large boundary conditions, in this case, the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So in those experiments, those are mostly modeling experiments. We were looking at pre-industrial conditions, so before the Industrial Revolution, and how variability, just like temperature variability, acted under those conditions. And then under using climate models, physical climate models, under a scenario where you double CO2 and you're no longer warming, you've just allowed the whole system to warm up to wherever it wants to be with a doubling of CO2, then looking at the variability in that scenario and comparing the two. And so what we found, this is counter to the narrative that you'll often see in the news these days. We found a large reduction in global temperature variability when the Earth is warmer. And the reason for that was that when the Earth is warmer, you melt a lot of the sea ice. And so when there's not sea ice in the system anymore, that means that you can't have this positive sea ice albedo feedback that contributes to variability. So I'll just say, like, in the pre-industrial state, you have sea ice there. And so when you have a natural bit of warming, you can melt some of that sea ice. And so then that causes less radiation to be reflected back to space and causes more warming. And so you have this positive feedback. We hear a lot about this positive feedback in terms of global warming, but this is also active under just natural variability. And so that causes there to be larger variability, where in the warmer system where you don't have sea ice at all, that feedback is not active. And so then you don't have as large of variability. However, a big caveat to that was that we did find that in lower latitude land regions, like over the Amazon rainforest, for example, that's where we actually found increased variability. And that's largely because as it gets warmer, it gets drier in those locations. And so then when you have some incoming energy, it's no longer used to evaporate water at the surface. It's used to warm up the surface. And so then you can actually get increased variability over land in low latitudes while you have a decrease in variability globally. So that's easier to show, like, with a map than it is in words. But that was, in essence, what we found in that study.
Well, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's possible that the weather might be hotter but somewhat more stable in a warmer world. Is that possible?
Yes. That's what we were showing, is more consistent temperature from decade to decade over most of the world under a warmer climate. And so, yeah, like that is counter to what is said a lot of times, where people say that as it gets warmer, it's also going to become more variable and more unpredictable. And our results don't show that. And so that's still something that's very hotly debated in climate science, for sure, is where and when and if variability will change. I mean, it's quite clear that the mean changes and gets warmer. I personally, scientifically, am skeptical of claims that variability will increase. I don't see it in the data. I don't see it in the observational data, and I don't see it in the modeling data either. So I would say that the main threat from climate change is not increased variability. It's just the raw increase in temperature and then increased time spent at extremely hot temperatures that are non-linearly damaging to things like crop yields and to human mortality and labor productivity.
I'll have to rethink a few things, because that seems different from, for example, what James Hansen pointed out when he was talking about a sigma 5 shift in extremes. We don't know what sigma 5 means, but we can sure see on a chart that he was showing that normal is shifting towards extremes, which then become the new normal. So it's hard for us to absorb the idea that, well, it may not be more stormy or wild, it just may be hot.
Yeah, so he has a graph where he shows like a bell curve shifts to the right and then it gets wider as it shifts, right?
Exactly.
So he actually did make a mistake there. So this is pretty much accepted that it was an incorrect calculation, that he started mixing different regions in that bell curve. And so what he's really showing is that different regions are warming at different rates, not that the variability at any given location is spreading out. So there was an actual mathematical mistake with that result. That's why all this stuff is still controversial. But, and also, the other thing is with extremes, like if the bell curve is shifting to the right, that naturally increases your warm extremes, right? And so we have to keep that as like a separate conceptual result, because that's like kind of a straightforward, obvious thing, that if you shift the bell curve to the right, the warm extremes increase. So yeah, the warm extremes will increase. The question is, do the cold extremes also increase? And the data shows no, really. I mean, the cold extremes are decreasing just as much as the warm extremes are increasing. And so that, you know, there's maybe some locations and some seasons where you can tease out and find that, oh, the cold extremes aren't decreasing as much as we would expect. And so maybe the bell curve is flattening a little bit, and then people come up with theories as to why that is, you know, having to do with the jet stream and things like that. But I'm telling you, from what I've seen, that is not a robust, strong signal in the data.
Wow. Well, you know, when I try to guess at the future during a climate shift, I recall the troubles my parents' generation went through. They suffered the Great Depression, then World War II, at least 100 million lives lost, cities bombed flat, genocide. And they got through it, some say stronger, but that's the kind of times I fear my grandson will have to navigate rather than what you and I have lived through. Given from what you know from climate science, how do you see the future, Patrick?
I am very hesitant to say anything definitive about the future. I just imagine people in 1920 speculating about what society and what the world will look like in 2020. And there's just no way that they could have, you know, guessed what would have come about. You know, this is before nuclear energy, before World War II, before, you know, way before the computers and the internet and cell phones and smartphones. And I would expect that the difference between 1920 and 2020 will be much, much smaller than the difference between 2020 and 2120. And so I really don't think that I have any authority whatsoever to say anything about the future other than what I can say about kind of physical climate science, which is very much in a vacuum compared to all of society and all of the future. So I don't know what the future will look like, and I don't honestly, I don't know how worried to be about climate change versus other things that you could come up with to be worried about. There's plenty of things that you could come up with to be worried about. And I wouldn't know exactly how to prioritize them, honestly.
I think I do. And I think that climate change is the major threat we face. I mean, there is nuclear annihilation, an asteroid arriving, all sorts of things could happen in society. But it seems like now climate change is a given from what we've already put up in the atmosphere. And I think we're going to have to prepare, adapt, and do what we can to get through it.
I agree with that. I think that there's much more uncertainty around the impacts than is often discussed, at least in the media, you know, and that is very much tied to human systems and how human systems react and respond. And so that's the thing to me that I end up just throwing my hands up and saying, you know, it's very difficult to make any type of quantitative projection as to how we expect the quote unquote world to be like if we're incorporating human society into that.
I see in your CV you have 4 more papers in preparation. What should we be looking for in your upcoming work?
So we've been working on a number of things. Honestly, the thing I'm most excited about is not even on my CV right now. I'm interested in wind and solar droughts, essentially. So if we do follow the market forces of wind and solar energy becoming much cheaper, as well as the legal mandates that we're imposing to have more wind and solar energy, then we expect that our future electricity generation system will be mostly based on wind and solar. And so that means that it will be more sensitive to weather variability than the current energy system. And so in particular, if you have a week or something over a large location like the United States, where you have reduction in wind and reduction in solar energy reaching the surface because it's cloudier, then you would have potentially, you know, a big problem in terms of energy production. And so since I'm in a department of climate science and meteorology, this is kind of a natural thing to study, is to study the meteorology associated with these wind and solar droughts. And then also if they were to co-occur with, you know, very hot temperatures, so that would be kind of a demand, energy demand flood, then that would be extra bad in terms of how the energy system, you know, it's stressed on the energy system. And so we're interested in studying that so that we can inform how to best create a future electricity generation system based primarily on wind and solar that's going to be the most robust to these natural oscillations in wind and solar energy resources. And I think that's something that's going to be more and more on the minds of energy system planners as wind and solar penetrates further and further and we start reducing coal and natural gas as producers of electricity.
You've caught my attention with that one. I'll be looking forward to it coming out from San Jose State University in California. We have been speaking with Dr. Patrick Brown. He's assistant professor in the Department of Meteorology and Climate Science. And we covered a lot of science here, and I will put links to the original papers in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you for talking with us again on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, it was great to be here. Thanks a lot.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.